and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, August 5th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga speaks to poet and activist Elle Jones. Based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Jones is a powerhouse in social movements focused on anti-racism, human rights, and decarceration. In September 2020, she was appointed chair of a 15-person subcommittee, which was tasked with defining Defund the Police in Halifax. Jones and the subcommittee compiled a 218-page report, which featured 36 recommendations to reallocate resources away from the police to more appropriate service providers. Jones has also appeared on past Off the Hill political panels, including Off the Hill, Whose Budget Is It Anyway?, and Off the Hill, Games of the Throne. You can listen to segments from both of those panels on previous Rabble Radio episodes, or find the full versions of the panels on Rabble TV. Today, Jones joins Kaluge-Kasuga to talk about how we value work and how to move past capitalist ideas of labor. The two also talk about how to create inclusive spaces in activist movements. Here are Jones and Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen. So thank you so much for coming on the show. To just start off, can you tell me a bit about kind of the activist work you do?
Yeah, so I do a lot of activism really focused on fighting state violence. So a lot of work with people in prison, organizing with people in prison, obviously fighting for prison rights, and then a lot of connected work with people facing deportation or immigration detention. I do also a lot of work with women experiencing violence, so women in prison, shelters, policing, of course. So really trying to work in those places where people mostly feel the sharp end of the state, and also, of course, trying to organize across different movements. So that touches on environmental justice, it touches on labor, it touches on all the different issues that we're fighting, and trying to build more of those solidarities as well.
And so can you tell me a bit about how much time it takes out of your day or your week to do this type of work?
I think when you're doing this kind of work, there can't be a schedule, right? Especially, for example, with prison, people get out and they call and they call. So you often get a barrage of calls, sort of like 7 p.m. is when everybody's getting out. And then you might spend 2 hours on the phone for the rest of the evening, or 3 hours of just call after call. But, you know, you might be in the middle of a run and somebody calls, and that's the time they have, 20 minutes. So it can be quite relentless. And then when you're in the middle of a campaign, so, for example, if you're familiar with the case of Abdul Abdi, which was a deportation that we were fighting of a Somali child who had been in foster care and then was being deported, that was 24 hours. I mean, we would be on the phone until 3 a.m., get up, go to work, you know, 6 a.m., get off work, get back on the phones. So it can be quite a bit of work, obviously, especially when you're in the thick of things, and very unpredictable. And I think you also have to give your full self. So when you start working on something, you really have to commit to it. I don't think you can tell somebody who's, you know, calling you from immigration detention, oh, I'm busy right now, I have a PowerPoint to make, right? So you sort of often have to drop what you're doing, commit to that, and then come back to whatever else you're working on. So it can also go quite long as well as quite intense.
And so how has having to commit that type of time and do all that work, like, affected you?
I mean, I always say that I think it's a blessing to be asked to do this work. You know, when people trust you enough to turn to you, I think that is an honor. So I would never complain about that. But it can be difficult, because I think that you end up on call for people. And of course, it's not just this work. Like, people also, if they know that you do activism, they'll call you in the community as well. And I think that's, like I said, I think it's a good thing. I wouldn't have the audacity to, you know, complain that people are calling you for help. But obviously, you're a human being, and it can be, you know, it gets hard. And sometimes, especially if you're struggling at that time in your life, it can be hard to give of yourself when you're thinking, but, you know, I don't have a permanent job, or, you know, I'm also fighting to get this, or I'm depressed, or whatever's happening. So sometimes in your personal life, I think it can get challenging if you don't feel that you're in a good place, and then trying to give of yourself when maybe you know, you might be struggling with getting things yourself. So that can be hard. But I think something I really try to remember is that any human rights case in particular that you're fighting, there is somebody whose rights are being violated at the center of that. And it's not about you, it's about them. And if they've managed to reach out to you, it's life or death really for them, but not for me. I can walk away at any point. I could say I'm not available right now. I could say, you know, I deserve time to myself. I could do all of those things and they couldn't stop me from doing it. Like they can't force me to pick up the phone. So it's exactly that dynamic that reminds me exactly why you have to commit to doing it. If you said you would do something and then you choose to walk away, I think that's just very unfair to the person who's been counting on you. So I think I just really try to hold that in mind and remember it's not about me, you know, but, and many benefits have come to me from doing this work. I'm the one that gets in the media. I'm the one that has a book, you know, like those things are real. The person that's sitting in a cell doesn't have the opportunity to write a book. They can't even get to a computer, right? So to also remember my own power in that situation, the own privileges I have to do this work because it is a privilege, but we are human beings, you know, and so, of course, there's days where you feel frustrated. There's days when you're like, can I lie down and take a nap? You know, there's, we're not saints, you know, and I don't want to be a saint. I think it's fine to be human, but it's also like very important to have an ethic and integrity around this work and understand why we do it and what we're here for and who we're here for and the community we're here for and everyone who came before us. Because we are not the first to do this work in 2022. You are not, I always say this, there's nobody doing activism now that is starting anything. We're not the first. We come from a long line of people that laid this work out for us. And we're just doing our small part and also handing it on to young people coming up too, you know? So I think if we keep that perspective, it's easier to sort of understand yourself and why you do this work and to keep really a perspective on it and not start to feel resentful or feel like you're special. Both of those things are bad.
So what keeps you motivated? Because it is very intense and involved.
I always say that, you know, it's the people that you're working with. There's intense love. And one of the things I always talk about is how when I saw Abdul for the first time after his deportation being stayed, you know, he ran towards me and he picked me up and twirled me around. And I felt so much joy. I never felt that much joy in my life because we had really struggled together. You know, we're still close. Like we don't just finish something working with somebody and then, you know, you're kicked to the curb. Like we have a relationship. We have love. You know, we're in each other's lives. We're family with each other. When I've needed things, people have come through to me with the little that they have. You know, so often it's been the people in prison when I've been down that have been like, well, what can I do? Like I have $50. I could give that to you. You know, like really that level of care. So I think that like just knowing that and knowing what you're here for, that's important. I never think the work is the problem. The harder stuff is the stuff that comes around it, right? There's a reason I'm not on Twitter, right? Like the people that will harass you, misrepresent your work, misrepresent your ideas. It can be very, very difficult when people are talking about you in particular ways. Like those kind of things I find difficult to deal with and I try not to deal with. Like don't read the comments, don't go on Twitter. Because that's what I think really gets inside you. That, you know, like you can be giving of yourself and then somebody will be like, oh, that person is just an SJW who sits around online and whines, right? And that's not who you are. And those people don't know who you are and they don't know anything about you, but they will misrepresent you. And especially as a Black woman, right? You'll be every negative narrative that they, you know, one day it'll be get a job, the next day it'll be you're elite because you have a job, you know, like it doesn't have to be consistent, right? It just has to be negative. So I think that stuff will really get you down. So I really try to stay away from that as much as possible and focus on the purpose. You know, we're here to do this work. We're here to do it together. We give our all. We're in relationship with each other. That is a beautiful thing. It's a hard thing, but it's a beautiful thing. And everything else, you just have to kind of walk out because that is the stuff that will keep you up at night. That's the stuff that will give you anxiety attacks, like the harassment, the people writing about you, people, you know, people have followed me in public, all of that, you know, but yeah. So I it's the work that motivates. And then everything around is just the cost. And you're not the first. I'm not the first to experience that either, right? So I always try to keep that perspective. You ain't special. I always try to tell myself that, you know, like this. So, and then of course the people that you're around, I mean, Lynn Jones, I'm lucky to live in a community with just an amazing elder like Lynn, who's taught me a lot of what I know about community organizing. Rocky, who taught me a lot about what I knew, Rocky Jones. So I'm very blessed to be in a community with the African Nova Scotian community with people who have been doing this work and were doing it long before it was cool and trendy, you know, and Desmond, Robin Maynard, you know, like we work together, we pick each other up. So there's a lot of love in this work and a lot of shared work and a lot of people carrying the load together. And I think that is also like, you know, you're with people that also are making the same sacrifice and understand the same thing. And I think that gets you up to do it. You know, like if you're not feeling great, you know, someone will pull you along with them.
Yeah, for sure. No, and that's a really beautiful thing to have the community and the collective as we do this work. I guess my next question then is about kind of conceptions of labor, because this is, it's necessary and important work, as you've made very clear. And, you know, we do have community that can help us uplift each other and support each other as we work through this, but we still exist in a capitalist society. So how have conceptions of labor and specifically of your labor affected you?
I think the first thing is, of course, to understand the roots of labor and Black people in general. Labor and Blackness can't be separated. This is quite literally the generative force of like, what is a Black person? Why are we not, you know, a nation in Africa, various nations? Why are we Black? Is, of course, from enslavement, which is the theft, exploitation of our labor, which is the roots of capitalism, right? So you can't understand Blackness or any current Black problem without returning to the idea that we were property for a long time, you know, and are often still seen as property. So in that context, Black labor is still often taken for granted, right? Especially Black women's labor, which is often put in a frame of being something kind of natural and nurturing. We know that from the civil rights movement, right? Like all the Black women that taught Martin Luther King. So, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, you know, like these are all Septima Clark. You know, these are the women that were organizers that taught King everything from the songs of the movement to how to organize. And nobody knows their names, very few people, right? Diane Nash, like, there's all these names of women. And then especially for Black women, there's just a kind of sense that we are made to do free labor and it's not even really labor. So I think that is difficult. But then I think the other thing that is important and difficult under capitalism is that we are always really encouraged to put a value, a monetary value on things under capitalism. So it's very easy to fall into an idea of, I'm doing this work, it's important work, it's hard work, why aren't I getting paid? And then you can sort of fall into the idea of people should be paying me for this. And of course, the value of it, as I said, isn't in anything outside. The value is an internal value, right? Like, what did we share with each other? What did we accomplish? Did we fight the state in the way that we needed to? Did we shift people's rights forward? Those are the real measures. But because obviously we're human and we live in a capitalist society and everyone wants nice things, you know, it can be very hard to sort of feel like I'm doing all of this and this person over there has a big job and this person got the grant and, you know, I'm not getting any money. And that can be difficult. But I think that's, we have to revalue our labor in that way and not, you know, think that the value is in putting a price tag on it. But I think that's very hard to decouple, right? The idea that hard work and valuable work, therefore, is paid work. So I think that that's a challenge, thinking about how to differently value things in community and how we can differently support working community. What would it look like if our communities were able and willing to collectively support this kind of work from everybody? And if everybody was able to have the resources to put in their time, because that's a privilege too. There's a lot of people with the skills and who want to do this work and can't because they're at their night shift and then coming home and caring for their kids, right? So it's also thinking about, there should never be a kind of class of people who are activists. And that's what happens. And I'm part of it. I'm not exempting myself from that critique, that there becomes a celebrity class of activists, the people who are the activists who end up in the media and end up on the panels about activism. And, you know, and there's this idea that those people do activism, but that's not a mass movement. A mass movement is by nature, everybody has the skills and capacity. Everybody is called upon to do what they can. Everybody gives what they can. And everybody is empowered and given the ability and resources to do that. So I don't think we can think about activism as separate from those issues, right? That why is this one person able to do it and these 100 people aren't? That one person, as I said, it's not that you're special. It's not that you know more. It's not that you have more energy. So activism can be very ableist, right? It can be very much like, if you can't come and stand for hours at the rally and then speak on the microphone, you're not an activist. When in fact, activism is all kinds of things. There's one vision that we see in the media, which is the people that speak loudly, right? But it's getting coffee for elders. It's picking people up and giving rides. It's making the signs. It's the emotional support. It's making the calls and having the call list. Like all of those things, you can't do anything without any of that, designing the flyer. So we tend to also privilege certain kinds of activist work that become, and this is very much anointed from outside our communities, right? So the media says, okay, that's a spokesperson. That person's articulate, and I'm putting that in quotes. That person's charismatic in quotes, that person's attractive in quotes, you know, all of these things that will of course feed into who gets to be the spokesperson or in the media, who they come back to, which is going to be classed and it's going to be by ability and it's going to be all kinds of other narratives. So I think it's also really important for us to talk about that within our movements and really think about how we open up this task of activism, which is a collective task, how it belongs to everybody. And it's not a case of, you know, you should come and pay me to do it. It's a case of how do we all gather resources collectively so that anybody who wants to do this should be given the ability, should have the contact with the mentors and elders to teach them, and should be, you know, able to use their energies as they want. Because like I said, that is a blessing. It's a very significant thing to be able to feel like you could put labor into the world and something could come of it. That I think is one of the most valuable things you can feel as a person. So everybody should be able to feel that.
How can we open up this work a bit more so that it's more of a mass movement and those who want to be involved can get involved?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that not everything everybody does is activism, but everybody can do activism. What I mean by that is that there are real strategies, you know, and these are practice things. There's been hundreds of years of Black people from the time of, you know, enslavement talking about these issues. And so we know what works, you know, like our elders have taught us, this is how you go into the meeting. This is what they'll do to you in the meeting. This is how to do a petition. This is how to do a this is how to organize long-term past. So often also we think of mobilizing as activism, right? So this is what Kwame Ture taught to us about, formerly Stokely Carmichael, right? That mobilizing is like a protest. Organizing is the long-term work of getting your ducks in a row all the time, right? And that's less glamorous. So people often don't want to do that work, right? Like everyone wants to come to the rally and be on camera. And, you know, it's the stuff that you might be doing for 5 years before that, that is the slow organizing work, the most thankless work. We often need to know that. I think especially for younger people who are the heart and energy of the movement, you know, younger people coming into movements, we need to do a better job of mentoring young people, giving young people training. Because, you know, so often people come in cold, don't get a lot of support, end up having a bad experience because you end up being dragged online or, you know, the right-wing press comes at you or whatever. And then people often leave because it was so traumatic. So I think we need to do a better job of passing down knowledge, recognizing that the state does not want us to know how a state is. Like, the state isn't here to be like, let me give you a grant so you can eliminate me, right? Like, yes, like, let's give you a grant to get rid of prisons. Like, that's not going to happen. So they're never going to resource the things that actually are effective. That's not their job. So they will always give us a twisted version, right? They will always tell us that Martin Luther King was just a charismatic person and there'll never be anyone like him. And, you know, he's solely by himself boycotted and marched across bridges. So that's what we believe activism is. And we don't know about the thousands of other people, the people who are on the ground locally, the people who made the flyers when the bus boycotts were happening. Like, we don't know that. So we think it's something else. So getting the right education around what organizing actually looks like and how much goes on behind the scenes. And we need to recognize that, yeah, like, no one's going to teach us that and we have to do more of that. And I think also really this is where mutual aid comes in, right? There's no transformative justice. There's no abolition without mutual aid. If we want to move away from the state, we have to build alternatives and they have to be practical and viable and possible alternatives, like housing. You know, like, we're going to go and join hands and stop the police from, you know, kicking people out of tents, but we also need to work for, say, land trusts where we could hold land in common in community and start to create safe housing, because the state isn't going to just like give us affordable housing. I really believe in, you know, obviously we have a big vision, like no more prisons, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. So we have to, on a daily basis, think about what can I do today? If I don't do anything because like my goal is so huge, and everything else is falling short of that goal, then we won't get anywhere. So we have to hold what we're moving towards and not compromise our principle on that, but understand that on the day-to-day basis, we are taking small steps through organizing together. It's not going to be in my lifetime. It's not going to be in your lifetime. It's not going to be in our grandchildren's lifetime, but we keep working and stepping towards it. And so I'm kind of like an everyday abolitionist, like just on the daily, what is it that we can do to bring ourselves one increment closer to that bigger goal?
Yeah, for sure. I kind of want to circle back to something you mentioned in that answer, just about how we value ourselves in this society around like money and titles and awards. How can we shift our thinking so that, you know, our relationship to the work we do for our collective and just to ourselves in general is not quite so capitalist.
You know, like I think often as activists, like we feel like we have to be humble, right? You know, so I think that sometimes we don't admit like what we want, or we don't admit some of those jealousies and things that and that's just human. And that's not a left eating the left thing, or that's just people. This is why bands break up, right? Like it's very human to be like, we're all doing the same work, but you're the one in the media. You know, we're all doing the same work, but you got a book and I didn't. Oh, why does this person have this? Or, you know, why do I work so hard and I don't have this? Like that is real, because it is hard to live check to check, and it is hard to not be able to travel, go on vacation, or see people when you want. Like these are things that people are really going through as they do this work. It's not a failing, but then I think we have to try and work to step past this. So why does my book mean more if it gets this award than if it's something I wanted to write and express myself? Who is teaching me that? Like, what is pulling on me to teach me that? You know, those are things that live in us. It's not about blaming ourselves. It's not about judgment. It's really just about thinking past. And I have to like, I keep saying capitalism, but that's really what it is. You know, it's really thinking past this value that has been placed on us within capitalism that's so hard to move through, because all our lives we've been told who's a successful person, who's a good person, who you should look up to, who's important. And it's very hard to shift that and say, well, maybe this person is important because they're the person people in the encampment trust to solve their problems. This person is important because they're an elder and they hold knowledge. And that's part of decolonization, right? So we also need to decolonize our movements and ourselves. And that is also a long-term project. It can be a very difficult project. And we just have to be, I think, open to it in ourselves.
And that's interesting. It's kind of in moving past the capitalist way of valuing labor, like through money and titles and awards, and kind of moving to like seeing it as like an act of love.
Yeah, well, when you're not laboring for yourself, I mean, Marx recognized this years ago, right? When Marx was talking about alienation, that when we do wage labor under capitalism, it alienates us from the work. It alienates us from each other. And it alienates us from ourselves, right? That was his whole point, that, you know, we no longer are connected to anything. I think that's a really important insight. You know, when we work for other people, our work is compelled. And yeah, we don't own our own labor. And then we don't have a relationship with ourselves, because so much of our day is doing things for other people that we're resentful of and have to force ourselves to do. Well, when we're laboring community, that is a choice. So we're not laboring for somebody. We're laboring with each other. So it brings us to ourselves. It restores us. It heals us, right? It de-alienates us. The wage, therefore, it's not about money. It's about owning ourselves and self-determination. And that is very powerful, right? But we still have to live, right? So we can't be naive and say that, you know, people can live on air and good works, you know? Like we all need to live. Like materially, people have families. People need to care for their kids. You need to put clothes on people's backs. We need to eat. All people deserve those things. But the answer isn't to get it for one person. Like now I stacked. It's to say, like, how do we all get this? And that has always been our task. How do we all get this? Not one of us are free until all of us are free.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. And you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
That was Elle Jones and Rabble Labor reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Elle and Gabby. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll leave it up to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, Rabble columnist, Indigenous educator, and writer Rachel Snow shares her thoughts on the Pope's recent visit to Canada. Snow writes that the response she's been seeing online to the Pope's visit and apology to Canada's Indigenous populations has been, quote, energy zapping to deal with, end quote. She argues people are asking for solutions that are too simple. Reconciliation is not simple, and the issue is far from being resolved. How can there be one approach or one solution to reconciliation when there are a multitude of First Nations and a multitude of actions taken that were meant to destroy the original peoples? Snow writes. She continues, we, the First Nations, are saying that if you cannot differentiate that we are many nations with many harms, then how can there be a resolution, let alone reconciliation? In health news this week, is Paxlovid being underutilized in Canada? Developed by Pfizer, Paxlovid is an oral antiviral pill that can be taken at home to help keep high-risk patients from getting so sick from COVID-19 that they need to be hospitalized. The medication can help the most vulnerable survive COVID, guest writer Anne McCormick writes, and yet, despite there being a supply, access to the drug is heavily restricted. Paxlovid is restricted to those who are 70 years of age or older, or at high risk. However, Public Health Canada deems those 60 or older as being at high risk for complications from COVID. People aged 60 to 65 account for 10.8% of COVID-19 deaths in Canada. As hospitals across Ontario close their emergency rooms due to staffing shortages, McCormick argues that treatments like Paxlovid can help relieve the pressure on the healthcare system. Making Paxlovid an at-home treatment available to COVID-sick people 60 years of age, regardless of their vaccination status, could help them avoid hospitalization, McCormick writes. Also on the site this week, as a part of our Boiling Point series, Rabble contributor Doreen Nichols spoke to environmental activists and farmers who practice regenerative agriculture. The term regenerative agriculture is used to describe the ways of farming that attempt to reverse climate change by rebuilding soil organic matter and restoring degraded soil biodiversity. Agriculture has taken a hard hit over the past few years due to extreme heat, drought, and other effects of climate change in Canada. Regenerative agriculture could be one way to fight this damage. For farmers like Thomas Elcombe, a market gardener specializing in organic microgreens, this looks like planting trees around his garden to canopy his plants and regulate temperature, brewing a compost tea instead of using synthetic fertilizer and pesticides, and diversifying his crops to ensure some varieties do well despite weather conditions. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'd like to leave you with, listeners, is this. Rabble has been proudly free from corporate influences for more than 2 decades. Amid our summer fundraiser, Rabble's national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel explains that his work is accountable to Rabble supporters, not private interests.
When I go out on the ground as a federal politics reporter for Rabble.ca, I'm always keeping 2 things in mind. One is to have the highest quality of work possible, and number 2 is to make sure that our donors get their money's worth.
We depend on the generosity of our listeners to ensure Stephen's reporting remains paywall-free and accessible for all. You can resist corporate media and support Stephen by contributing a monthly gift to Rabble. Visit rabble.ca/donate for more information. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.